On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Have you seen the face of an actress who, in all her performances, from Search and Destroy to Die For to Grace of My Heart to Cape Fear, she has a gift for expressing an eagerness for experience. That actress is Ileana Douglas. She sits across from me. Her memoir is I Blame Dennis Hopper. I Blame You. Thanks for being here.
I'm blushing.
But that is the thing that, and even from the book, there is this kind of hunger for experience in the book that's just kind of wonderful.
Yes. I don't know if that means, you know, I have amnesia, even though with every, you know, single, even if something is a bad experience, as soon as I step on a set or I'm about to do something, I just think, isn't this incredible? Isn't this amazing that we get to do this? I don't know what happens to me. And I've always retained that through the ups and downs of my career.
But there's this thing that I think sort of besides the fact that your lineage,
yes,
your grandfather being?
Melvin Douglas.
I'm sorry, Academy Award winner, Melvin
yes,
Douglas.
And Tony and Emmy. And,
yes. EGOT almost.
Yes.
But I think what's so interesting about that too is just your stories about spending time with him in the book are just kind of wonderful.
Oh,
and
thank you.
If you talk a little bit about just being on the set of being there, because that's kind of wonderful. First of all, this shaggy guy just kind of wandering around the set who turned out to be...
Yeah. someone named Hal Ashby, who I didn't even know at the time. I mean, I was, you know, so young. I didn't have any understanding that people made movies. I mean, movies to me were, you know, I had posters on my wall of, and I knew I wanted to be in the movies, but what that meant to me and the way I expressed it to my grandfather was that I wanted to be Ruby Keeler, because that was my first. I was obsessed with Busby Berkeley musicals, and then later with Liza Minnelli and the, you know, those kind of musicals. But so when he first invited me to the set of being there, it was this revelation. Well, the first revelation was, you know, driving to the set in a town car, which coming from the commune and the hippie upbringing, that I was like, I like this. It seems good. But we drove to the set. And my grandfather had a bit of a cold, and we went to the, you know, Asheville, to the Biltmore estate where they were shooting, and it was going to be the scene with Jack Warden and Peter Sellers, and I could literally barely breathe when they brought me onto the set, because first of all, I couldn't believe the amount of people. So it was this understanding that people make a film, and they sat me in a chair, you know, next to this guy with his shaggy hair, and I was like, okay, that guy seems like he's in charge. And of course, that guy turned out to be Hal Ashby, who's the first thing he said to me was, you know, what do you think? And I said, it's a lot of people. And he said, it is a lot of people. And, you know, and then went about his work. It was as if it was all a dream. But, you know, I was very good all day, and I sat next to Hal Ashby and watched him direct my grandfather and Peter Sellers. And at the end of the day, I said to my grandfather, can I meet Peter Sellers? So he said, oh, Peter, I think we have an Inspector Clouseau fan here. And immediately Peter Sellers launched into this Inspector Clouseau routine, accusing me of being part of a French baguette stealing ring. And everybody was laughing. It was, you know, very charming. And then he kind of got sort of serious when he looked at me and he said, do you know how to ride a unicycle? And I said, no. And he said, oh, but you must learn to ride a unicycle because it's hard and not everyone can do it. And it was, you know, it was like, okay, sort of interesting thing to say. And I'd sort of forgotten about it, you know, for many years. And then I was going through kind of a rough time. I'd moved back to New York, and I decided to go to a psychic because I always think, you know, men go to prostitutes, women go to psychics. We both spend money looking for answers that we never really get. But I went, and it turns out she wasn't a psychic. She was a medium. So who do you want me to contact? So she contacts, I said, oh, I guess my grandfather, Melvin Douglas. So she contacts him. And while she's contacting my grandfather, she said he's with someone. And she described this image of a man, he's surrounded by pink, and he's doing like a tic-tac-toe on his forehead. And I suddenly had this flash that in my childhood bedroom, I had a picture of Peter Sellers from a People magazine cover, and it was indeed pink. And I said, is it Peter Sellers? And she said, yes, it is. He's nodding. He's saying it is. And then all of a sudden, she got this quizzical look on her face, and she said, he's riding a unicycle. Does that mean anything for you? And I just couldn't believe it. That was just like this odd tie into. I said, yes, I think I know what that means. And then, you know, we had this long sort of communication, at which point Mr. Sellers and my grandfather wanted me to come back and watch the movie Being There and have the medium translate. So I thought, how could I miss this opportunity to get commentary from beyond? And I did, in fact, make an appointment, and I went back and we watched the movie Being There, my grandfather, Peter Sellers, commenting, but not before. I had returned home and I thought, well, okay, is this really real? But I thought, wow, how could she pull something like that out, a unicycle? And I went to my home in Connecticut. I went into the basement, and there in the basement was a unicycle. I don't own a unicycle. I had not purchased a unicycle. Came riding up. I saw my brother and I said, there's a unicycle in the basement. Where did it come from? And he said, yeah, isn't it great? I found it at the dump today, and I'm going to learn how to ride it. And as soon as he said, I'm going to learn how to ride it, I just had that. I looked up like, okay, Peter, I get it. And that has become for me so much of a symbol of who I am, what my career is, and really the journey of an artist, which is to be on a unicycle, because it's hard and not everybody can do it. And it requires balance and it requires tenacity. And I think that, you know, somebody like Peter Sellers, and I like to think of myself as a rememberer, you know, of people. And I think he was so misunderstood. And in many ways, I didn't know him. I just met him. But he was so kind to me. And even in that one meeting, like those meetings that I you know, experienced that day, they've sort of stayed with me. And so then I become the rememberer that will translate those stories. And hopefully other people then will be inspired, you know, by my stories.
It's the truth. My guest who co-opted my book, Men Go to Prostitutes, Women Go to Psychics, is Ileana Douglas. Her memoir is I Blame Dennis Hopper. It's funny because clearly the book almost starts like you can't take it with you. I mean, it's a big theatrical family, really, in its way, a very theatrical family. And this is the point you get to explain the title of the memoir to the audience, because that could be like a 60s hippie version of you can't take it with you, that the house you grew up in.
That's a great analogy, because when I first saw that film, You Can't Take It With You, I thought, oh, that's my family. It was completely nutty like that. But it's called I Blame Dennis Hopper because, I mean, you know, first of all, my parents were big like movie buffs anyway. They dated through going to the movies. They used to go to the Thalia. They lived in the Village. They'd go see all the foreign films. And they went to see Easy Rider. And they just came back from the movie and they were transfixed. And although they had just moved to Connecticut to start basically what I think of, and this is my opinion, like the American dream, you know, living in the suburbs away from New York City, they saw that movie and my father came home and decided to leave his job and convince my mom. He's like, we're going to start a commune and live off the land and have goats and chickens. And that's what they did. He started a commune called The Studio. And pretty soon it was filled with, you know, hippies. And everybody in my childhood looked and sounded and acted like Dennis Hopper. They all had the bandanas. They all wore choppers. They went to peace rallies, you know. I actually thought that my father invented Earth Day. I thought that because I was so young, you know, they'd get on their motorcycles. I thought that was their work, to go to these, you know, rallies and listen to the Beatles.
But there's a guy who came to the house a lot who sort of lived with you guys who you thought kind of was sort of a Dennis Hopper type.
Yeah, Tom the hippie. And he was Tom, we, you know, again, I always say, like, I don't know where they found hippies then, because there was no internet or hippie handbook. But Tom the hippie showed up. And, you know, they all start to bring people. It's like, well, Tom brought Annette, and Annette brought Michael, and he brought Jane. And, you know, and next thing you know, you got a house full of hippies. But all listening to, you know, Steppenwolf, you know, and saying, that's what it's all about, man. But no, Tom the hippie was, again, a series of father figures for me, that he used to have this great, like, Dodge van, and he'd ride around, he'd, like, you know, smoke pot and then drive us around in it. And it didn't have a back seat, so he cut tree stumps for us to sit on. And he'd be driving so fast and listening to his Neil Young that he wouldn't realize he'd take, like, a fast turn and the stumps would fall over. And one time we rolled, like, right out at the back of the car. It was like, Tom!
Well, but there's a symmetry to this, because you got to, through your concussion, meet the person after whom the book is named.
You have to imagine. I had a childhood, again, like, where it seemed like a movie. There were all these characters from a movie. My parents were in their own movie, you know. They were in the hippie, you know, doing the whole hippie lifestyle. They had the poster of Easy Rider in the living room, you know. They had all the vestiges of that, of the hippie lifestyle. And so there was no money to go to college or anything. So it was like, yeah, poor starving artist. I think I can do that. I think I know how to do that. And I very much wanted to impress my grandfather, you know, starting with, again, going on the set of Being There. I just thought, okay, career options. I can do this. This is what I'll do. I'll become an actor. But I very much always felt stigmatized for growing up poor. I certainly blame my parents, because I always felt as if they chose that lifestyle. And, like, what, you know, why did they have to see that movie? Until I met, doing a movie, Search and Destroy, and Dennis Hopper gets cast as my father figure type lover, of course.
We should say who the director of Search and Destroy was, a pretty famous artist.
David Sally. David Sally, who I had gotten to know in New York, and I had seen this play, Search and Destroy, and wanted to adapt it to a film, and wanted to be with Griffin Dunn. Basically, all movies I've ever done are my excuse to work with people I love. And I was obsessed with Griffin Dunn. But yeah, I couldn't wait to meet Dennis Hopper. And on the day I was supposed to meet him, we were driving to the set, and again, the theme of poverty, starving, comes in again. The PA, who had not eaten and not slept, fell asleep at the wheel, and we had a three-car pileup on Park Avenue South. And when I woke up to him sort of screaming over me, police arrive. The movie was so low budget, we didn't even have a walkie-talkie. I'm like holding my head going down Park Avenue South. And by the time I got to the set, I was lying on the ground, this like cold marble ground, and they're waiting for the ambulance to come. And at that point, I see my life flashing before my eyes. I hear my father. And then I realize, oh my God, that's not my father. That's Dennis Hopper. And I have Dennis Hopper like cradling me in my arms, asking me how I am. And now I had this whole speech planned for when I was going to meet him. But of course, now it came out like, you know, and he said, it's okay, you're going to be okay. And I said, no, I'm crying because my father saw Easy Rider, it changed his life. And now we're going to be working together, and it's a miracle. It's a miracle. And that's when, at that point, he said, Ileana, you've had a concussion. But in that moment with Dennis Hopper and with me, you know, tears streaming down my face, I realized, I was like, I am the child of Dennis Hopper. We are all the children of Dennis Hopper. Without him, I would not be here. And I just thought, who else has the opportunity to, you know, how one man and one movie, in a sense, changed my life. And now he's helping me. It was my ultimate dream.
We will take a break. Some of us are born into poverty. Others have it thrust upon them. Ileana Douglas is one of those people. Her book is I Blame Dennis Hopper. There's more to come. Stay with us. So
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day. Find Today's Top Tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
Welcome back. My guest who managed to equate the Grateful Dead and Led Zeppelin in the break is Ileana Douglas, but let's not talk about music. Her terrific book is I Blame Dennis Hopper. And I do want to get back to this thing I was saying in the opening, where you as a person are driven by this appetite for experience. And I wondered, because you found that a way to translate that into so many of your performances, so as you're writing about Cape Fear in the book, and that's a character who is basically literally disfigured by this appetite for experience. And I just wonder if that's something you found a way, I mean, when you kind of recognize that as being this kind of motor that drives you as an actress.
I don't. And I mean, it's amazing that you say that. Like, I approach every role by just trying to say, you know, I'm a movie lover. And what haven't I seen in a movie? And trying to make it as truthful and as honest as possible and be in the moment as much as possible. One of the things I did with Cape Fear, when I read the original script, I mean, I didn't think that it was very truthful. It seemed like, oh, the office tramp gets hers. And I had been profoundly affected by, when I was at school, there was at the neighborhood playhouse, a girl had been murdered in our class. And again, she just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. And then we also had the Jennifer Levin case again, you know. And to me, it was like something that was just about seconds, you know, just being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I wanted that character literally not to know what was going to happen to her until seconds before it actually happened. Because in my experience, that's how life is. You don't approach life going, you know, originally they had the scene like the guy's putting the handcuffs on her and she's like, hey, what are you doing? I stop that. But to me in real life, that's why we get ourselves in trouble. We go along. We're like, all right, well, I'll figure out some way out of this. Okay, and you don't know until that second. You're like, uh-oh, this is bad. This is really bad. And so that's what I worked on really hard. I wanted her to be a nice person because I thought it would be a lot more poignant if something horrible happened to a nice person as opposed to the cliche of like, well, she's a tramp, so she deserves whatever happens to her.
But there's a part of you that, and it runs through the book, is almost always looking forward to the next day.
Yes, that's true. Because who am I going to meet? See, yesterday I'm hanging out with, you know, Michael Nesmith, and today I'm here with you. Life does not get better than
this.
Trust
me, it gets better than this. That name she just dropped was Michael Nesmith. But anyway, we're talking with Ileana Douglas. Her really fun, terrific book is I Blame Dennis Hopper. And sort of in concert with that, if you pardon the expression, you worked on the film To Die For, and there's a great story that's in the book. I want to have you read the section of the book that illustrates how this sort of eagerness to do things, and including your own life and your work, really pays off.
Now, this is on the wonderful movie To Die For.
And directed by Gus Van Sant, we should say.
Yes. That camaraderie of looking out for each other was a reflection of the environment that Gus created. At times, To Die For felt like a home movie. One day, I was kidding around with Matt Dillon, and he accidentally broke my thumb. Gus, rather than hiding it, wanted to incorporate it into the movie. We have to take advantage of it, he said excitedly. It's real. She's a skater and she fell and she broke her thumb. It worked for the documentary feel of the film. When you look at a movie like To Die For, you can tell how Gus was breaking the rules as a director because it's really an independent film mixed with a studio film, juxtaposing the documentary style improv within a Buck Henry script, brilliantly casting people such as Joaquin Phoenix, Casey Affleck, myself, opposite the China doll beauty of Nicole Kidman. I always thought To Die For was wrongly identified as a black comedy. To me, it's more of a film with a social commentary, part Mankiewicz in its storytelling, for example, the flashback technique used in A Letter to Three Wives, part Wilder in its cynicism, like the very dark film about Fame, Ace in the Hole, a fascinating look at American values told through the eyes of its victims and its victorious murderess, Suzanne Stone. True, the films You Aren't Anybody Unless You're on Television no longer play as satire. In that way, To Die For predicted the future and the culture of celebrity. I always kept mixtapes that I would listen to in my trailer to get me in the mood for various scenes. Gus would come in sometimes just to hear what I was playing, which for that film was usually a 60s mix of The Beatles, Neil Young, and Donovan. That sort of thing. Gus was in my trailer when he heard Donovan's Season of the Witch. I was thrilled when it turned up in the movie's last scene in the background music while I'm skating. Another time we were shooting Matt Dillon's funeral scene, Gus came running into my trailer and said, "Do you have any sad music?" In the scene, Nicole plays a song for everyone at the graveyard. Well, the song I picked out that day was Imagine by John Lennon. We did the scene, and it evokes strong emotions in everyone. Gus said it worked so well that they would have to get the rights to use it. Well, it turns out Imagine costs too much, and that's a shame, because boy, did that song work for that scene. In the end, they used Eric Carmen's All By Myself, which, if you notice in the film, is slightly incongruous with everyone's performance. But I was thrilled to be able to contribute some musical ambience, like an emotional DJ.
My guest, the emotional DJ she is Ileana Douglas. Her book, a really fun book, is I Blame Dennis Hopper. And you mentioned Mankiewicz there, and you got a chance to meet Joe Mankiewicz.
Oh, my goodness.
It's interesting because you mentioned Hopper here and then Joe Mankiewicz, and a lot of the people you end up talking about, certainly Gus Van Sant as well, these people who are really kind of, who can see everything in front of them, mm-hmm. and take everything in and can immediately make these kinds of assessments. And one of the big examples of that to me, and kind of a sort of ne plus ultra in terms of people you met, is your story about Marlon Brando in the book.
I was in L.A. doing a very low-budget movie, and Martin Scorsese was going to be out here. He was going to be getting a humanitarian award, the John Huston Humanitarian Award. And I always have these autograph books that I carry with me. And that night I brought...
And these books you had since you were a kid, just collecting these things.
Since I met Roddy McDowell, and he said to me, "You're going to meet a lot of interesting people. I'm one of them."
Yeah, I mean, so basically the beginning of your career in L.A., just again, yeah. As a kid, he just said, "Listen, you got to do this." Because he did that.
Yes. And thank God he did it, because I was able to reference a lot of the conversations I had. But I was very despondent, because I had left my autograph book at this award thing, and it had, it's silly, but it had Alan Rene in it and a poem from Sean Penn and all these things that for me, I'm a rememberer. I'm an archivist. I don't know why they mean so much to me. Some of it, I'm sure, is the sense of like it's proof that I made movies, that I met these people. I get great enjoyment, as a movie fan does, in looking at these things. And I lost the books. I was very despondent. I was going to have Marlon Brando sign the book. So in a fit of pique, when he came, I was like, well, I'm not even going to wear anything nice. I put on this like lumpy brown sweater, and Marty was all nicely dressed in Armani.
Well, if Armani's giving you clothes, you'd be nicely dressed too. Anyway.
But, so it was with that state of mind, I met Marlon Brando, and he came to the door. It was the Beverly Wilshire. And we were supposed to have lunch with him. And I just thought, this is going to be my act. He's here to see Martin Scorsese. Just, I've read books. I know how to be a nook of me, just sit there. Just be quiet. Just be like his quiet, stunning, statuesque girlfriend. And, and go make rice in the other room or something. I don't know. That was like my image. But he came to the door. And he said that he didn't want prying eyes. He didn't want to eat and downstairs. So could he come in and we'd have lunch in the room? And so immediately sort of a little bit of panic set forth. I ran out of the room to cancel the reservations. I came back in the room. And at that point, Mr. Brando, there was these two French provincial chairs, and Marty was sitting on like a club chair. And Mr. Brando had taken all of the cushions sort of off the chair and was laying on them like a pasha. So he was taking up the entire couch. And what was so arresting about him was his eyes. Did you ever meet Marlon Brando?
I never did.
Oh, my God. Okay. Like somebody from another planet. His eyes were sapphire blue, and they just sparkled. I mean, they sparkled like the sun, hitting the top of the ocean. They really did. And on top of it, he was wearing a matching velour sweatsuit, which was also sapphire blue. And he was enormous. You know, he told Marty he'd lost weight. And I was
like, 30 pounds.
Yeah, he said, I've lost 30 pounds. How do I look? And I was like, from what? Like 300? Who made that suit? But I just thought, I can't look at him. Because if I look at him, I'm going to start crying. You know, he's Marlon Brando. And Marty had said to me, as he often did, don't
be a fan is what he said in effect.
Yeah. So he was sitting there. I could feel my heart just sort of racing. And then Marty said, well, you know, Ileana's grandmother was Helen Gahagan Douglas. And so Brando, you know, he looked up. And I remember, like, I was like, could I talk for the side of my face? So I sort of tried to talk, but I had no breath. I suddenly, my words just kind of, and then I went, oh, my God. And it was at that point I heard Marlon Brando say to Marty, so this is your lady friend. And I just thought, what does that mean, you know? And suddenly there was like silence in the room. You know, in their silence, you haven't been paying attention anyway. I'm like, I look up and I'm like, Marlon Brando staring right at me. And then he goes, look at your feet. And I looked down and I noticed that my feet were inverted towards each other, pigeon-toed. And he said, that's a sign of insecurity. Why should you be insecure? And Elvis, I don't know. I mean, I'll cry just reliving it. So I just decided to say, I am insecure, you know. And as I said, because you're Marlon Brando and, you know, everything you are, everything I want to be is because of you, everything I've strived to be. And as I started to tell him this, I just got really, really emotional. And his gaze just like, it sounds like a cliche, time stands still. Time stood still. And in that moment, those waves of energy just suddenly went from me to him, to back to me. And I could not stop myself from talking. And I just was like this outpouring of love that I started to express to him. And he said, my God, you're a tuning fork. Now I'm crying. And then he was crying. And then Marty, he like jumped up from his chair to go get a Kleenex. And we're locked in our crying thing. And then Marty goes and gets the Kleenex. And he's like, he goes, she's very emotional, Marlon. You have to forgive her. She lost her autograph book last night. And it's my fault because they hustled me out of there. He goes, they hustled me out of places. So then Marty's now confessing about his thing, how he feels it's his fault that I lost the book. And all three of us like crying. Meanwhile, you know, again, as I think back on it, that's one of the beautiful moments of life. Now, all this other life is happening right outside. Deals are being made. Things are happening. People are having lunch. But inside, the world is stopped so that three people can meet each other, meet the real, unique person who they are. And Marlon Brando, in that moment, taught me to be authentic. You know, because I'm an actor. I break apart a scene. The scene is a girl wants to be a famous director's obedient girlfriend, not add anything to it, just play your role, right? But Marlon Brando enters the scene and he says, you're more than that. I see something in you. You're a tuning fork. I don't care about the meeting or the movie. None of that's important. What's more important for Ileana and Ileana's growth is that you're a tuning fork. I can see the love that you have in you. And you've brought it to me, and we're now on a different wavelength. And that, to me, was just, it changed my life. I mean, it was a great emotional lesson about being yourself and not caring so much what other people think and trying not to play a role for anybody.
Well, that's what I was saying in the opening, just this appetite for experience. We're out of time. I can't thank you enough for doing this, really. Oh. Thank you so much, Ileana.
Thank you.
The book is I Blame Dennis Hopper. I blame you for the book. It's really fun.
Thank you.
No, thank you. Let me thank a few people here. Our recording engineer, who also mixes the show, Kat Yore, and Blake White, who is associate producer and edits the show. I don't blame anybody. It's the treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.